It's the Larry Kudlow Show. Free market prosperity starts here. Now, here's Larry Kudlow.
Hello, folks. I'm Larry Kudlow. This is the Larry Kudlow Show. It's a great pleasure to be with you. By the way, just to set it up, you can hear us over the internet, live stream us, LarryKudlowShow.com, LarryKudlowShow.com, and you'll be able to get us all across the country, around the globe, throughout the solar system and the Milky Way. And by the by, please join us during the week on TV, Fox Business Network. The name of the show is Kudlow, 4 to 5 p.m. every day, 4 to 5 p.m. every day, Monday through Friday, Fox Business. And if you can't get us at 4 for some reason, just text your favorite 9-year-old, and she will show you how to DVR the show. No problem. So we have a bunch of things to talk about today. The economy is heading towards recession, according to leading indicators. Jay Powell might pause. The debt talks in Washington have all but broken down. Democrats don't want to cut spending. There's a shocker, isn't it? Democrats don't want to cut spending. Don't want any budget reforms. And really the biggest news this past week that I want to spend some time on today, along with these other topics, was the report from Special Counsel John Durham about the so-called Russian hoax. And the FBI and the CIA and dirty tricks and breaking the law. It is a remarkable report. If you haven't read it, I mean, it's 300 pages. I don't expect everybody to read it. But you ought to read about it. I would recommend my columns in the New York Sun or posted on Fox Business. Wall Street Journal editorials are very good. We will have distinguished attorneys and former prosecutors, Greg Jarrett and Andrew McCarthy, on later in the show at the top of the next hour. Durham on the Democrats, corruption on a grand scale. Okay? Corruption on a grand scale. That sums it up. And this was the FBI, the CIA, the Department of Justice, the White House, the media, mainstream media, all corrupt. Democratic corruption. Let's make no mistake about this. This is corruption in Democratic administrations going all the way back to Obama. And then Hillary Clinton's campaign, and then Joe Biden's administration. And I want to say something at the very outset. If you haven't heard it, I'm going to say it. And that is, Donald Trump, who was the target of this during the campaign in 2016, during his administration, during his impeachment, during the nonsensical Ukraine, Donald Trump has been completely exonerated of every charge, of every major charge, of every minor charge, of every peripheral charge. And in the Durham report, he says there was no actual evidence of collusion between President Trump or his campaign and Russia. Let's just repeat that. The Durham report says that the FBI lacked any actual evidence of collusion between Mr. Trump, his campaign, and Russia. And in fact, digging deeper into the Durham campaign, it actually looks like this whole fabrication, one of the great political scandals of all time, is a Russian intelligence operation. And of course, this was through the infamous Steele dossier and all that came out of that. This was a Hillary Clinton plant the idea of the Steele dossier and the various allegations, and then the role of the FBI, which has been involved now in two different elections, 2016, 2020, and God knows they may be involved in 2024, the way they're treating these whistleblowers. This was a Hillary campaign plan, deliberate. Barack Obama knew. I mean, they were briefed in the Obama White House. They were briefed on this plan. Obama knew, Biden knew, they all knew. And, of course, did nothing about it. And, of course, the FBI and the CIA played along. Heads should have rolled. I mean, a lot of people lied under oath. But it was Hillary's foreign policy advisors that generated this plan and briefed President Obama. And former CIA John Brennan offered briefings. Former Attorney General Loretta Lynch, FBI Director James Comey, they all heard about it. They all knew about the phony campaign. They all knew the Steele dossier was phony. Remember, Steele was working for the Clinton campaign. This was financed by the Clinton campaign. And the Durham report covers it very well. Give them a lot of credit. Give them a lot of credit. And all these FBI people, names that at one time or another were familiar in the news, Kevin Kleinsmith, who doctored and phonied up a FISA warrant, Lisa Page, her boyfriend Peter Strzok, and the mainstream media with their Pulitzer Prizes, the New York Times and the Washington Post, that should give it back, give the Pulitzer Prizes back. Give a Pulitzer Prize to Miranda Devine of the New York Post, who blew the whistle on the Hunter Biden laptop, which is really not part of the Durham campaign, but it came out. The Hunter Biden laptop, the FBI had this laptop a year before political operative Antony Blinken, who later went on to be Secretary of State. He's a dirty trickster. You know, we learned that just more recently. Blinken told Mike Morrell, a former CIA deputy, to put together a letter that argued the Hunter Biden laptop story in the New York Post, broken by Miranda and others in the Post. This was a phony Russian disinformation. 51 former intel operatives, including, of course, John Brennan. I mean, really? And the FBI played along. That was in the 2020 campaign, before the second debate between Trump and Biden. This is part of this broader story of FBI corruption and CIA corruption, helping to destroy American democracy, and, of course, interfering with our presidential elections, and Lord knows what else these clowns have done. Lord knows what else these thugs have done. This guy Blinken, he's going to be in such deep trouble. He will be subpoenaed in front of Congress. He's already lied before Congress. And as a political trickster and longtime Joe Biden confidant, he winds up being Secretary of State, which is the top job in the American government, in the cabinet. America's top diplomat. Incredible story. All these guys lied. Polls show, a lot of polls show people have known the Hunter Biden laptop with all of its corruption on it. If that were real, they would have voted for Trump, not Biden. So it could have swung the whole election. This is the CIA and the FBI operating in favor of a Democratic Party candidate. Remarkable stuff. All this has now come up. And I want to talk about it today. I want to spend some time talking about it today. Trump was completely exonerated, okay? Completely exonerated. Corruption on a grand scale. There's no other way to put it. And now, one question that I want to explore today on this, which hasn't been solved yet, is how do we keep the FBI and the CIA, I want to focus more on the FBI, but how do we keep the FBI out of the next election in 2024? Because you're seeing, you know, the hearings held this past week by Judiciary Chairman Jim Jordan about these whistleblowers who have been punished. Many of them are political conservative whistleblowers in the FBI. They get special immunity. There are laws protecting them. And the FBI has gone ahead and punished them, moved them out of the headquarters into far-flung offices. In some cases, preventing them during a move, but their stuff was in storage. They couldn't even get it. Babies couldn't even get their clothing. They were treated like dirt because they have information and had information about FBI corruption down through the years, or about FBI mishandling cases, not just the Trump Russian hoax case, but other cases. And more recently, information concerning this Hunter Biden corruption, you know, you've got every member, all of Joe Biden's family and close friends, all of Hunter Biden's family and close friends have these LLCs, you know, they're chartered as small businesses, set up, I mean, you know, wives, ex-wives, cousins, uncles, college roommates, you name it. There's about a dozen of them or more, maybe as many as 20 of them. People are investigating this. Jim Comer's investigating this. Jim Jordan's investigating this. Great patriots that they are. And the FBI is treating them like dirt, burying them, firing them, stopping their pay, even though they should be legally immunized. So some of them are coming forward to talk about this. And again, we see the corruption inside the FBI. You tell the truth in the FBI, you get punished. If you tell the so-called truth that implicates Democrats, you get punished. If you tell the truth that implicates Republicans, you're rewarded. What is it all about? Where's the G-men? Where's the nation's top police force? What was Jim Comey doing? What was Robert Mueller doing? Why weren't they investigating? Why were they fixing warrants in FISA? Foreign Intelligence Court that was set up many years ago during the height of the war against terror, set up by George W. Bush. I don't disagree with W. about that. I'm saying what these guys did is perverted it. Perverted it. One thing after another. This is one of the worst episodes. You know, the FBI was under fire many years ago. I mean, J. Edgar Hoover started out, I guess, as an honest G-man and founded the FBI, but he became corrupt. And then, of course, during the Nixon years, FBI corruption was rampant. But after hearings, and I remember William Webster, Judge William Webster, who actually was a Jimmy Carter appointee. I believe he was reappointed by Ronald Reagan. He set the agency straight. But this... The entire FBI should be on trial. Let me just repeat this. Donald Trump was completely exonerated for these Durham reports. The left-wing media won't deal with it. I'm sorry about that. But that is the reality of the Durham report. And this guy Durham is solid, straight, strong, backed. Cautious, took a long time. There was never any actual evidence of collusion between Trump or his campaign and Russia. Made up stories, one after another. And the cover-up was protected by the FBI. Trump exonerated. And it will give Mr. Trump, whoever you're for out there, you may be for Trump, you may be for DeSantis, you may be for somebody else, but it will give Trump a lot of power and momentum as the GOP presidential primary heats up. It gives him tremendous momentum. And it raises the question regarding the FBI and the Justice Department and other agencies about these other judicial, these lawsuits and so forth that look like weapon, politicalization, weaponization against Donald Trump and Republicans in general. But what I want to explore, in addition to all of this, is how to keep the FBI out of the next presidential elections and presumably presidential elections beyond that. That's a key point. Because it isn't the rank-and-file FBI agent. It's the people running the agency, the so-called seventh floor at the old FBI building in Washington, D.C. They are the liberal Democrats. They are the ones who have undermined our law and our democracy. They are the ones who acted crookedly during the whole Russian hoax, and since then, they have to be cleaned out. We must totally clean house. I don't want to get rid of the FBI. I don't want to destroy the FBI. I want the FBI to be the FBI. That's what I want. I want the FBI to be the FBI, the nation's top cop. I want them to live up to the virtues and principles of their charter. I want them to become patriots, but there has to be a massive house cleaning in the FBI. Not one or two people. Not new regulations. Individuals have to be taken out of there. I don't know whether it's 50 people or 100 people, but all these stories, if you look and read in the Durham report, you see time and time again, people on the so-called seventh floor, the headquarters, the top brass, interfering even with what the rank and file were doing regarding these investigations that Durham describes. Middle-level people going directly to people on the seventh floor, bypassing their immediate superiors in order to run roughshod over law and order because of their democratic left-wing biases. I want the FBI to be a great policing agency. Lord knows, we need law and order in this country. In the cities, particularly. We need them to do their job.
This is the Larry Kudlow Show. It's the Larry Kudlow Show. Free market prosperity starts here. Now, here's Larry Kudlow.
Hello, folks. I'm Larry Kudlow. This is the Larry Kudlow Show. It's a great pleasure to be with you. By the way, just to set it up, you can hear us over the internet. Live stream us. LarryKudlowShow.com, LarryKudlowShow.com. And you'll be able to get us all across the country, around the globe, throughout the solar system and the Milky Way. And by the by, please join us during the week on TV, Fox Business Network. The name of the show is Kudlow, 4 to 5 p.m. every day, 4 to 5 p.m. every day, Monday through Friday, Fox Business. And if you can't get us at 4 for some reason, just text your favorite 9-year-old And she will show you how to DVR the show. No problem. So we have a bunch of things to talk about today. The economy is heading towards recession, according to leading indicators. Jay Powell might pause. The debt talks in Washington have all but broken down. Democrats don't want to cut spending. There's a shocker, isn't it? Democrats don't want to cut spending. Don't want any budget reforms. And really the biggest news this past week that I want to spend some time on today, along with these other topics, was the report from Special Counsel John Durham about the so-called Russian hoax. And the FBI and the CIA and dirty tricks and breaking the law. It is a remarkable report. If you haven't read it, I mean, it's 300 pages. I don't expect everybody to read it. But you ought to read about it. I would recommend my columns in the New York Sun or posted on Fox Business. Wall Street Journal editorials are very good. We will have distinguished attorneys and former prosecutors, Greg Jarrett and Andrew McCarthy, on later in the show at the top of the next hour. Durham on the Democrats, corruption on a grand scale. Okay? Corruption on a grand scale. That sums it up. And this was the FBI, the CIA, the Department of Justice, the White House, the media, mainstream media, all corrupt. Democratic corruption. Make no mistake about this. This is corruption in Democratic administrations going all the way back to Obama. And then Hillary Clinton's campaign, and then Joe Biden's administration. And I want to say something at the very outset. If you haven't heard it, I'm going to say it. And that is, Donald Trump, who was the target of this during the campaign in 2016, during his administration, during his impeachment, during the nonsensical Ukraine, Donald Trump has been completely exonerated of every charge, of every major charge, of every minor charge, of every peripheral charge. And in the Durham report, he says there was no actual evidence of collusion between President Trump or his campaign and Russia. Let's just repeat that. The Durham report says that the FBI lacked any actual evidence of collusion between Mr. Trump, his campaign, and Russia. And in fact, digging deeper into the Durham campaign, it actually looks like this whole fabrication, one of the great political scandals of all time, was a Russian intelligence operation. And of course, this was through the infamous Steele dossier and all that came out of that. This was a Hillary Clinton plant. The idea that Steele dossier and the various allegations and then the role of the FBI, which has been involved now in two different elections, 2016, 2020, and God knows they may be involved in 2024, the way they're treating these whistleblowers. This was a Hillary campaign plan, deliberate. Barack Obama knew. I mean, they were briefed in the Obama White House. They were briefed on this plan. Obama knew, Biden knew, they all knew. And, of course, did nothing about it. And, of course, the FBI and the CIA played along. Heads should have rolled. I mean, a lot of people lied under oath. But it was Hillary's foreign policy advisors that generated this plan and briefed President Obama. And former CIA John Brennan offered briefings. Former Attorney General Loretta Lynch, FBI Director James Comey, they all heard about it. They all knew about the phony campaign. They all knew the Steele dossier was phony. Remember, Steele was working for the Clinton campaign. This was financed by the Clinton campaign. And the Durham report covers it very well. Give them a lot of credit. Give them a lot of credit. And all these FBI people, names that at one time or another were familiar in the news, Kevin Kleinsmith, who doctored and phonied up a FISA warrant, Lisa Page, her boyfriend Peter Strzok, and the mainstream media with their Pulitzer Prizes, the New York Times and the Washington Post, that should give it back, give the Pulitzer Prizes back. Give a Pulitzer Prize to Miranda Devine of the New York Post, who blew the whistle on the Hunter Biden laptop, which is really not part of the Durham campaign, but it came out. The Hunter Biden laptop, the FBI had this laptop a year before political operative Antony Blinken, who later went on to be Secretary of State. He's a dirty trickster. You know, we learned that just more recently. Blinken told Mike Morrell, a former CIA deputy, to put together a letter that argued the Hunter Biden laptop story in the New York Post, broken by Miranda and others in the Post. This was a phony Russian disinformation. 51 former intel operatives, including, of course, John Brennan. I mean, really? And the FBI played along? That was in the 2020 campaign, before the second debate between Trump and Biden. This is part of this broader story of FBI corruption and CIA corruption, helping to destroy American democracy, and of course interfering with our presidential elections, and Lord knows what else these clowns have done. Lord knows what else these thugs have done. This guy Blinken, he's going to be in such deep trouble. He will be subpoenaed in front of Congress. He's already lied before Congress, and as a political trickster and longtime Joe Biden confidant, he winds up being Secretary of State, which is the top job in the American government, in the cabinet. America's top diplomat. Incredible story. All these guys lied. Polls show, a lot of polls show people have known the Hunter Biden laptop with all of its corruption on it. If that were real, they would have voted for Trump, not Biden. So it could have swung the whole election. This is the CIA and the FBI operating in favor of a Democratic Party candidate. Remarkable stuff. All this has now come up. All of this has now come up. And I want to talk about it today. I want to spend some time talking about it today. Trump was completely exonerated. Okay? Completely exonerated. Corruption on a grand scale. There's no other way to put it. And now, one question that I want to explore today on this, which hasn't been solved yet, is how do we keep the FBI and the CIA, I want to focus more on the FBI, but how do we keep the FBI out of the next election in 2024? Because you're seeing, the hearings held this past week by Judiciary Chairman Jim Jordan about these whistleblowers who have been punished. Many of them are political conservative whistleblowers in the FBI. They get special immunity. There are laws protecting them. And the FBI has gone ahead and punished them, moved them out of the headquarters into far-flung offices. In some cases, preventing them during a move, but their stuff was in storage. They couldn't even get it. Babies couldn't even get their clothing. They were treated like dirt because they have information and had information about FBI corruption down through the years, or about FBI mishandling cases, not just the Trump-Russian hoax case, but other cases. And more recently, information concerning this Hunter Biden corruption. You know, you've got every member, all of Joe Biden's family and close friends, all of Hunter Biden's family and close friends have these LLCs. You know, they're chartered as small businesses. Set up, I mean, you know, wives, ex-wives, cousins, uncles, college roommates, you name it. There's about a dozen of them or more, maybe as many as 20 of them. People are investigating this. Jim Comer's investigating this. Jim Jordan's investigating this. Great patriots that they are. And the FBI is treating them like dirt, burying them, firing them, stopping their pay, even though they should be legally immunized. So some of them are coming forward to talk about this. And again, we see the corruption inside the FBI. You tell the truth in the FBI, you get punished. If you tell the so-called truth that implicates Democrats, you get punished. If you tell the truth that implicates Republicans, you're rewarded. What is it all about? Where's the G-men? Where's the nation's top police force? What was Jim Comey doing? What was Robert Mueller doing? Why weren't they investigating? Why were they fixing warrants in FISA? Foreign intelligence court that was set up many years ago during the height of the war against terror, set up by George W. Bush. I don't disagree with W. about that. I'm saying what these guys did is perverted it. Perverted it. One thing after another. This is one of the worst episodes. You know, the FBI was under fire many years ago. I mean, J. Edgar Hoover started out, I guess, as an honest G-man and founded the FBI, but he became corrupt. And then, of course, during the Nixon years, FBI corruption was rampant. But after hearings, and I remember William Webster, Judge William Webster, who actually was a Jimmy Carter appointee. I believe he was reappointed by Ronald Reagan. He set the agency straight. But this... the entire FBI should be on trial. Let me just repeat this. Donald Trump was completely exonerated for these Durham reports. The left-wing media won't deal with it. I'm sorry about that. But that is the reality of the Durham report. And this guy Durham is solid, straight, strong-backed, cautious, took a long time. There was never any actual evidence of collusion between Trump or his campaign and Russia. Made up stories, one after another. And the cover-up was protected by the FBI. Trump exonerated. And it will give Mr. Trump, whoever you're for out there, you may be for Trump, you may be for DeSantis, you may be for somebody else, but it will give Trump a lot of power and momentum as the GOP presidential primary heats up. It gives him tremendous momentum. And it raises a question regarding the FBI and the Justice Department and other agencies about these other judicial, these lawsuits and so forth that look like weaponization against Donald Trump and Republicans in general. But what I want to explore, in addition to all of this, is how to keep the FBI out of the next presidential elections and presumably presidential elections beyond that. That's a key point. Because it isn't the rank-and-file FBI agent. It's the people running the agency, the so-called seventh floor at the old FBI building in Washington, D.C. They are the liberal Democrats. They are the ones who have undermined our law and our democracy. They are the ones who acted crookedly during the whole Russian hoax, and since then, they have to be cleaned out. We must totally clean house. I don't want to get rid of the FBI. I don't want to destroy the FBI. I want the FBI to be the FBI. That's what I want. I want the FBI to be the FBI, the nation's top cop. I want them to live up to the virtues and principles of their charter. I want them to become patriots, but there has to be a massive house cleaning in the FBI. Not one or two people, not new regulations. Individuals have to be taken out of there. I don't know whether it's 50 people or 100 people, but all these stories, if you look and read in the Durham Report, you see time and time again, people on the so-called seventh floor, the headquarters, the top brass, interfering even with what the rank and file were doing regarding these investigations that Durham describes. Middle-level people going directly to people on the seventh floor, bypassing their immediate superiors in order to run roughshod over law and order because of their democratic left-wing biases. I want the FBI to be a great policing agency. Lord knows, we need law and order in this country. In the cities, particularly. We need them to do their job.
This is the Larry Kudlow Show. It's the Larry Kudlow Show. Free market prosperity starts here. Now, here's Larry Kudlow.
Hello, folks. I'm Larry Kudlow, and we welcome to the show Senator Roger Marshall, Republican of Kansas. By the way, it's Dr. Senator Roger Marshall. I don't think I knew that exactly. Anyway, Senator Marshall, welcome.
Larry, great to be on with you again. We got a lot happening, don't we?
What kind of doctor are you?
I'm an obstetrician gynecologist.
Oh, how wonderful. How wonderful. Yeah. I don't think I knew that.
For 25 years of my life, I delivered a baby most every day. The greatest honor of my entire life was that magic moment of giving a crying baby to a new mom and dad, an incredible life I've been blessed to live.
Well, that's a wonderful thing. God bless. Terrific stuff. So, Senator Marshall, I've been talking about John Durham's report, Donald Trump's exoneration, but most of all is the corruption inherent in the FBI. I would include the CIA, but I'm kind of more focused on the FBI right now with respect to the Russian hoax. There was no evidence of anything done. And I want to get your thought on that. And then I want to move on to the issue of how we can clean up the FBI, because this is really important. I'm very concerned that the FBI, which has interfered in the 2016 election, interfered in the 2020 election along with the CIA, may have thrown the 2020 election against Trump and toward Biden, that they may do the whole thing again. But first, Senator, what's your thoughts on the Durham report?
Well, Larry, I think your op-ed nailed it. Let's make the FBI great again. One of my senior physicians once told me early in my practice, if a physician loses their reputation, you never get it back. The FBI has lost their reputation. My dad was a police officer, chief of police for 25 years. We had the most reverence for the FBI. They were the gold standard for law enforcement agencies across not just the country, but across the world. We've lost that reputation. There is absolutely corruption at the highest levels in the FBI, and they're the ones that are colluding. They were colluding with the Justice Department. They were colluding with the Obama-Biden White House as well. But the mainstream media just says, oh, this was a nothing burger. There was nothing in the Durham report. That's what maybe disturbs me as much as anything.
You know, the thing, one of the things, there are many things, but one of the things that just burned me up was the information that this was a plot, a plan, a plot hatched by the Clinton presidential campaign, the Hillary Clinton presidential campaign, and that the White House, the Obama White House, including Biden, including Attorney General Loretta Lynch, they were all briefed on it. They knew about it. And then, of course, the FBI helped enforce it from one to another. But it's remarkable to me, and they all kept silent. I don't know, to this day, I don't think Obama's ever said anything about it. But this was at the very highest levels of our government. And I just find that to be quite remarkable. And the other thing, Roger Marshall, that I want to mention is... The idea that there was never any evidence whatsoever, of collusion. It was all a political dirty trick. And when you think about what we had to go through with Trump and the attacks during the campaign and then during his administration and ultimately his impeachment, that's how far this dirty trick went. I just find that utterly incredible.
Right, Larry, and why hasn't the national media asked former President Obama about this? Why haven't they asked Vice President Biden about this? We've not talked about the FISA court application either.
Yes.
And I think that that's, people are missing a point here. FISA application allows them to spy on people to higher levels. And when you start abusing that and the Justice Department colluding with the FBI, basically they used a newspaper report that the FBI created, and then they circle back and say, based upon this newspaper report that we planted, we want to be able to spy on the Trump folks as well. And then later they use that trick in the COVID cover up as well, and that's a story for a different day. But this is a theme, to your point. This is the tip of the iceberg. We need to clean out the FBI.
So one of the things that occurs to me watching all this and reporting on all this, you've got the Jim Jordan hearings this week. What were they, Wednesday or Thursday, interviewing some of these FBI whistleblowers. Some retired, some still around, and how they attempted to call attention to irregularities or law breaking or other problems, other process problems, and they were smashed. I mean, basically conservative whistleblowers, but in some cases not just politically conservative, just people that saw law breaking and how the top brass in the FBI treated them so badly. And so I'm looking at this, Senator Marshall, as a leading indicator of God knows what in the 2024 election. What will the FBI do next if they're not cleaned out?
Yeah, that's a great question, Larry. But again, to your point, this is the swamp. The Obama administration did an incredible job of placing folks into the FBI, the Department of Agriculture, the FDA, all those places. Those folks have risen to the top levels now, and then they're pushing out folks maybe with a more conservative approach. And I hate to use the word conservative. I think it's a traditional American patriotic approach are being pushed out. So all we can do is keep shining a light on them. I'm not sure on the House side what they can do to work with the budget issues. As we are confirming people for some of these higher spots in the Senate side, we can keep putting pressure as well. But I don't underestimate exactly what you're talking about.
Well, my thought is that I don't look, when I served in the Trump administration, I sat on National Security Council. I dealt with the FBI and the CIA for that matter. But I'm concerned that it's going to take the only way out of this. I don't want to destroy the FBI. I don't want to defund the FBI. I want the FBI to be very strong. As I said in the article, I want it to be great again. But I don't think there's any way out of this, Senator Marshall, unless we have a very strong Republican president. If Biden's reelected, there's no hope of cleaning out the FBI or the CIA. We're going to need a change in administrations. We're going to need a strong, strong president to clean house on the so-called seventh floor of the FBI, right? It's not the rank-and-file agents that are doing this stuff. It's the people at the top who have a very liberal Democratic bias. You're going to need a strong president, it seems to me.
Larry, leadership is so important, and it's in such short supply. We'll need, at every level, we'll need strong leaders to be able to deal with these people and start investigating them and run them out. That's what we have to do. You and I have seen it in other agencies where we've got to just run out the bad people. And to your point, though, the FBI agents out in the field that I've met with have been nothing but incredible human beings. We've been working with them hand in glove on the fentanyl issues in Kansas. They are great men and women. This seems to be at the highest levels, and particularly in that field office in Washington, D.C.
Yeah, I think that's the tricky part. What, if anything, is going on in the Senate to follow up on the Durham report and to look at whistleblowers and to look at the FBI? Is there anything going on?
With crime running rampant in New York, you need to keep yourself and your family safe. Obtaining your concealed carry firearm licenses can be difficult and time-consuming. That's where MyFirstPistol.com comes in. They'll help you secure your concealed carry license. If you're looking for a pistol, premise, rifle, or shotgun license, call 347-559-7052. 347-559-7052. You must have a valid firearm license issued by the NYPD to purchase, possess, or shoot a handgun or pistol in NYPD.
Larry, you got me there. I think that we are just living from crisis to crisis, and I don't know whether this is on purpose or this is just the way this administration manages. But when we have a southern border, the most immediate national security threat to our country going on the one hand, then we have our national debt crisis and our debt ceiling crisis, the bigger long-term threat to this country going on. There's really not much room for much in between, it feels like.
Yeah, so nobody wants to hold hearings on this in the Senate. I'm not surprised. Democrats really don't want to.
No.
I mean, you would think, I'm just speculating here, I'm sort of wandering, but you would think there would be some Democrats who would have the same view of the importance of a straight, honest, law-abiding FBI. I mean, FBI is a very important institution. And, you know, your comment at the top here, when doctors lose their reputation, they can't get it back. When the FBI loses its reputation, it's going to be awful hard to get it back. I mean, FBI was in a web of corruption during the Nixon years. That was a problem. But eventually, under William Webster, it got its reputation back. But now this stuff coming out, and there's going to be follow-through. I'm surprised there aren't some Democrats. I mean, not all Democrats are bad or evil. There are some good Democrats out there. Some of my best friends are Democrats. I was a Democrat 50 years ago. I worked for Ronald Reagan. He was a Democrat once. Trump was a Democrat once. There's got to be a couple of good ones out there.
Larry, they are, but it's about prioritizing our time. In the Senate, just like your job, you have to prioritize what can we get done today. And we're living from crisis to crisis right now. And it would take leadership on the Democrat side to do this and say what you want to about the Democrat Party. They're even in shorter supply of leadership, people willing to stand up and do the right thing. I would think someone like an Angus King, some people, some senators in purple states would like to do this, but to the chairman of the Judiciary Committee is Dick Durbin, a good friend, a person that I'm able to work with. And it would be an interesting conversation for me to have with him to say, where are you on this? Because I do think deep down inside, we all want a stable FBI. We want our basic rights protected. But there is just simply not much oxygen left in D.C. to get beyond this debt crisis.
Yeah, you know, that's interesting. Durbin's the head of Judiciary, is that it?
Yes, sir. That is correct.
Yep. When I was a host at CNBC years ago, I interviewed Dick Durbin a couple times. I actually thought he was a pretty decent guy. I know he's big, you know, a big liberal Democrat, but still, I thought he was a pretty interesting guy. What, Senator Marshall, what's doing in the Senate about the border collapse? I mean, we haven't seen any substitution for Title 42. There's no Remain in Mexico. There's no Build the Wall. There's no change in catch and release. Now the illegal migrants are filtering through the interior of the country, and we can't handle them. What's happening there? Anything interesting?
Well, unfortunately, once again, not, Larry. Again, your listeners, I understand that this administration wants this crisis. They want an open border. They want 10,000 people crossing our border every day for some political reasons. But the big concern is national security. This is the number one national security threat our nation faces. I took a group of senators to the border the eve as Title 42 ended. And we got there. We saw hundreds of people crossing the border, busload after busload of people being shipped to a holding center. Those holding centers had been emptied out of 3,000 people as well. 3,000 gotaways the day before we got there. 3,000 gotaways, 90 Chinese nationalists crossing the border every day in China. We have no idea how many terrorists and criminals, 300 Americans dying every day from fentanyl poisoning. How does Joe Biden sleep at night? How could he possibly look at those parents and brothers and sisters and friends in the eyes and say, there's 300 American, young Americans dying every day from fentanyl poisoning, which is crossing our southern border? How does the man sleep at night? I don't know.
You know, with all of the talk, I mean, when the day came and Title 42 ended and people crossed the border and so forth, and they'd been massing on the border, sort of lost in all this is that the Bidens never did and still haven't substituted anything for Title 42 or come up with any decent border control policies or sought to deal with the cartels that are running the border. In other words, nothing's changed. I mean, it just they're just sort of sitting back, allowing them to cross, and then I guess they're getting sent around the country. But there's no new policy.
Again, Larry, you nailed it. I just love your common sense approach. Every time I've been to the border, this is my fourth time, I'll ask the Border Patrol officers, what can we do to help you? The first three times, we need more, you know, send the National Guard, send us troops, send us nurses, send us doctors. But this time, what they've asked for is policy. What they said we need the Biden administration to go back to the previous administration's policies, the Remain in Mexico policy, stop the catch and release. That's the only thing that's going to stop this this beacon of come one, come all, come get your free Medicaid, your free food, free health care. Everything's free in America. Come today, come yesterday. Yeah. So they want a policy change, to your point, not more resources. Yeah. Of course, they would love to secure the border more efficiently. But yesterday, Joe Biden could change this yesterday with his pen by just renewing some type of Remain in Mexico policy.
That's it, the Remain in Mexico policy. Senator Roger Marshall, we're going to take a quick break. If you can give us a little more time on the other side. I want to talk about the debt ceiling and what you think about that and what's going on in the Senate, because we're not hearing a thing from the Senate side. We're talking with Senator Roger Marshall of Kansas. I'm Kudlow. We'll be right back, folks.
Larry Kudlow. This is the Larry Kudlow Show.
Welcome back, folks. I'm Larry Kudlow. I'm talking with Senator Roger Marshall of the great state of Kansas. And Senator, the debt talks have broken down in the House. I know they did come back. They had a 10-minute meeting yesterday morning, and then they walked out. Garrett Graves led the House people out because the Democrats just wouldn't do anything. They did get back at 6:30 last night, but nothing really is going on there. And, I mean, this is not going to be a shocker to you, but, I mean, at the bottom of this, I mean, I've been through some of these types of negotiations, and many years ago in the Reagan years, I was a deputy at OMB, so I know a little bit about the budget. The Democrats don't want to cut spending, okay? They don't want to cut spending. Now, right. That may not be breaking news, but that's at the root of this whole problem. And they also, by the way, don't want to give permitting to fossil fuels, and they also completely rejected the idea of stopping the cancellations of student loans, and they don't want to stop any of the greenie tax credits in the misnamed inflation reduction bill. But the heart of these negotiations, and I've got some moles inside them, people that used to work for me when I was in the White House, they don't want the spending caps. They don't want 10 years. They don't want $5 trillion of reductions. They don't want to limit the frenzied spending of the Biden administration. I mean, that's at the heart of this. So I guess I'll try to make a question here. The Freedom Caucus is saying very clearly, stay with the McCarthy plan. This is very interesting. And what's the Senate going to do? Where's the Senate plan? Chuck Schumer, you know, is always criticizing, but he's got nothing. So is there anything going on in the Senate?
Well, thankfully, there's not, Larry. Any deal that Kevin McCarthy can cut with Joe Biden is going to be better than any deal we can get in the Senate. So I'm proud the Senate has stuck together, kept their mouth shut, and that gives Kevin McCarthy the ground cover, the air cover that he needs. People need to realize the only voices that matter, again, are Joe Biden and Kevin McCarthy. The ball is in Joe Biden's court. The pressure is on him in these negotiations right now. And we need to keep coming back to why this is an important fight, why this is so important. This is important to my children and grandchildren. Our $31 trillion national debt is the number one long-term threat to this nation. It's a threat to our national security, our economy. It's a threat to building roads and bridges in the future. It's just a threat to good schools, all those things. And to your point, the Democrats want to spend money, and raise taxes on the wealthy and people that are successful. So this is our one time when we're in the minority in the Senate that we can use this as leverage, because they need 60 votes on the Senate to get something across the finish line. So they're going to need some of us. We're staying together on this. This is a sword we're going to die on. We're not going to blink. Joe Biden has to come to the table and give us some of these things that you just went through, including work requirements.
Well, they're fighting work requirements, too. I mean, there's the welfare work requirements, by and large, are still in place. The big problem is the food stamps, SNAP. They're fighting on that, on various eligibility exemptions. But the big one, the big nut, is Medicaid, which has become such a gigantic spender in the budget. And Democrats don't, I mean, Biden doesn't want to include Medicaid in the work requirements. So that's right. Another sticking point.
Yeah, if we could just talk about that just for a second, Larry. I would love for you to guess how many people you think are on Medicaid, but I'll give you the answer. 85 million Americans are on Medicaid right now. 85 million. Wow. Half of America's children are on Medicaid. And look, you and I are compassionate people. I'm a physician. I volunteer at clinics, do everything I can to help people. But Medicaid's the most broken government system we have. Instead, I'm trying to work towards building up community health centers. Bernie Sanders and I are working on that. But think about the work requirement we're asking for. You don't have to have a work requirement if you have children. And all we're asking is 20 hours a week, 20 hours either working or getting an education. We as conservatives need to lean into this. Having a job is a great thing. It creates self-respect, dignity, all those things. We should celebrate somebody getting a job. And that's what's going to lift those children out of poverty, is if their parents have a job. So I think it's a very reasonable, I think it's the right thing to do. Not only reasonable, it's the right thing to do. I don't understand why Democrats want to keep people in poverty.
Yep, there's no opportunity to climb the ladder of success if you're living on government benefits. That is for sure. Anyway, Senator Roger Marshall, we appreciate you coming on today. Good luck. We'll talk some soon. Get you on back on the TV show. Folks, I'm Kudlow, and on the other side of the break, we've got Greg Jarrett and Andrew McCarthy. I'm going to talk some more about this FBI-CIA problem and the Durham report. It's just so important.
It's the Larry Kudlow Show. Free market prosperity starts here. Now, here's Larry Kudlow.
Welcome back, folks. I'm Larry Kudlow. This is the Larry Kudlow Show, and it's a great pleasure to be with you. We're going to bring in two very distinguished attorneys, former prosecutors, and actually, I think Greg Jarrett was a defense lawyer, too. But anyway, we got Greg Jarrett. Greg Jarrett is a Fox News legal analyst, New York Times best-selling author. His book, Trial of the Century, his newest book, release date May 30th, about the Scopes Monkey Trials. Phenomenal story. And Andrew McCarthy, former district U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York, a Fox News contributor, National Review contributing editor, National Review Institute, and his recent book, Ball of Collusion, The Plot to Rig an Election and Destroy a Presidency. Boy, you guys, you know, the stuff you wrote before is very apocryphal. John Durham, you know what? John Durham has exonerated Trump, but he's exonerated your writings. Think of that.
Somebody had to excuse my writing, so I'm glad to hear it finally happened.
I know, it's just terrific stuff. So there's a bunch of things I'd like to talk about. Andy, let me start with you, Andy McCarthy. The FBI aided and abetted this whole Trump collusion scandal. They aided it and abetted it. I mean, the role of the FBI is something I've tried to focus on the TV show this past week. And I'm very, very worried that, you know, they've interfered in 2016. They interfered in 2020. God knows they may interfere again in 2024. I don't want to absolve the CIA, but I'm more focused on the FBI. So tell us, they aided and abetted the Russian hoax.
Yeah, Larry, I think that Durham did a very good report. It's comprehensive. He built on some of the reporting that had already been done, particularly by the inspector general, who was limited in his investigative tools compared to a full-blown prosecutor. You know, Durham was able to issue subpoenas and use the grand jury and that sort of stuff. So I'm generally favorable toward what John Durham did. And I know him personally. He's a person of great integrity and scruples. But I do part company with him in the conclusion he draws from the fact that the FBI was raised up in the summer of 2016, in July of 2016, about the fact that our spy agencies had intercepted Russian intelligence analysis that said that Clinton was planning to smear Trump as a Russian asset. Durham's criticism of the FBI over that is that they ignored this intelligence when they were doing their own analysis of the information that was coming to them, and they weren't cognizant enough of the fact that they might be being fed disinformation. And to my mind, the best interpretation of his report is that the FBI was intimidated by Clinton, that they believed she was going to be the next president, that they were afraid of reprisals if they bucked against what the Clinton campaign was doing. And I don't think the FBI ignored this evidence. I think the FBI, to the contrary, understood that Clinton's theme was that Trump was a Putin puppet, and they went along for the ride, I think, quite knowingly. I really don't think this was ignoring. I think this was getting on board the train.
Well, Greg Jarrett, why did they ignore it? Why did they go on the train? I mean,
well, because
is this just politics? Right. Okay.
You know,
go ahead.
The FBI, top echelon of the FBI, James Comey, Andrew McCabe, Peter Strzok, Lisa Page, they hated Donald Trump. They loathed his policies. And they made a conscious decision to do everything they could to prevent him from getting elected. And when that plan failed, they doubled down. And as Durham makes clear, you know, they had no credible evidence, no actionable intelligence that, that Trump included with Russia, but they didn't care. They never vetted or corroborated anything. When they eventually got around to it, they discovered that there was no evidence, that it was largely based on a Hillary Clinton-commissioned dossier that was a collection of pernicious lies. They debunked it. They, you know, discovered that it came mostly from Hillary Clinton's confederates, Charles Dolan and Igor Danchenko, and some of it was Russian disinformation itself. Yeah. In a way, you know, Trump didn't collude with Russia, but in a way, Hillary Clinton and her confederates did. You know, I go to page 81 of the report, and it says that, you know, the FBI, the CIA obtained reliable information that, quote, Hillary had approved a campaign plan to stir up a scandal against Trump by tying him to Putin and the Russians. And, you know, in my new column coming out this weekend, I point out that the people who knew this were Barack Obama, Joe Biden, mm-hmm. James Clapper, the DNI, the Attorney General Loretta Lynch, and others. And you know, for 3 years, they knew this but remained silent. And the silence, in order to hide the truth, is, in my judgment, a lie.
Andy McCarthy, I mean, is it the seventh floor of the FBI? I guess that's where the top brass are. I mean, right. What are their are they just all a bunch of liberal Democrats? Is that what the deal is?
I think they're certainly the guys who were in that regime were left-leaning. I mean, you know, one of Trump's gripes about Andy McCabe, who was the hands-on, he was the deputy director, and as Greg mentions, the headquarters of the regime there was very hands-on in this. And one of Trump's gripes about him was that he got funding, or his wife, who was running for state legislature in Virginia, got funding from an outfit connected to the Clintons' pal, Terry McAuliffe. But, you know, I think you deal with people who have left-of-center leanings, even though, you know, Comey served in the Bush administration. He served in high-level positions in administrations of both parties. But I really think this is more about, I don't think these guys are so much political ideologues as they are, you know, practical politicians who understood which way the wind was blowing, and they thought that Hillary Clinton was going to win. And they were afraid of, with good reason, I think, they were afraid of reprisals. My personal view, Larry, for what it's worth, is that if Clinton had won, she'd have fired Comey on the first day. Mm-hmm. But, because, you know, they like to blame her, they like to blame Comey for the fact that she lost, and it was a big deal that Comey announced that investigation was reopened 10 days before the election. But as I often point out to people, if Comey hadn't absolved Clinton and said that no reasonable prosecutor would have indicted her, which I guess makes me an unreasonable prosecutor, if he hadn't done that, she wouldn't have had a campaign. He could have killed her campaign there and then. So, you know, for all their squawking about it, I think that, they owed Comey more than they'd like to admit.
But, you know, Greg Jarrett, it's interesting to me, just in a common sense way, all right, if they weren't all ideologues, left of center ideologues and so forth, but they weren't passive. The FBI was active. I mean, they were driving this thing through against Trump every step of the way, really. I mean, the FISA Corps is one example, but other examples, either not pursuing leads. I mean, the Wall Street Journal editorial today is very interesting about Robert Mueller, his role in all this. Now, Mueller was, I first met Mueller during the George W. Bush administration. I met him at a dinner at Dick Cheney's house, the vice president's house. You know, he was well regarded. He was regarded as somebody on the team. And then he, you know, goes against Republicans. I mean, maybe it's his hatred of Trump. I don't know. I mean, what were Trump's policies that the FBI disagreed with anyway? Is there an institutional problem here? Is there something the FBI... I mean, Trump was basically a law and order president.
Well, Andy's point is well taken, that they assumed, based on polling data, that Hillary was going to be the next president of the United States. And I think that influenced their decision-making to go after Trump, but to turn a blind eye to Hillary. And not just her email scandals, in which, in my judgment, she clearly violated the Espionage Act and committed obstruction by destroying records under subpoena, but relating to her foundation and other activities, there were four separate investigations by the FBI that Comey effectively shut down. You know, and Durham in his report, he minces no words. He describes the FBI's double standard and the quote-unquote dual system of justice that it produced. For example, Hillary received the courtesy of a defensive briefing about corrupt foreign actors. Trump did not. The FBI rejected a surveillance warrant on Hillary Clinton from the secret FISA court while seeking four successive spy warrants involving Trump's campaign. You know, and of course, to secure those intrusions, exculpatory evidence was deliberately withheld from the judges. Supporting documents were altered by Kevin Kleinsmith, an FBI lawyer who eventually copped a plea to it. I mean, Comey deceived the judges, vouching for the credibility of a dossier that the FBI had already debunked. And he represented Steele was reliable, not telling the judges, oh, by the way, we fired Steele for lying. He was a confidential informant. So, you know, the irony embedded in this collusion con, I think, is fully exposed in the Durham report. Instead of conspiring with Putin in the bowels of the Kremlin, Trump became the victim of Clinton-induced Russian disinformation that helped fuel the dossier.
But Andrew McCarthy, so now Trump is president, and then before you know it, we've got an impeachment hearing on all this Russian collusion stuff. But doesn't the FBI continue its campaign against Trump? And why?
Yeah, well, so you remember the infamous conversation in, I guess it was September of 2016, by where Peter Strzok essentially says that they have an insurance policy.
Right.
Now, as we all know, you know, insurance is what kicks in if the disaster happens, right? Not before.
Yeah. Yes.
And to them, the disaster was Trump being elected. Which is how a lot of these guys viewed it. And the insurance policy was that they had this counterintelligence investigation in place. It was mainly run even after Trump was elected and should have been able to put a halt to it. It was run by Obama administration holdovers. Remember, Comey continued on at the FBI and Sally Yates continued on at the Justice Department. And one of the first things that they did with the Trump administration is get Jeff Sessions to recuse himself and get Mike Flynn, who was the national security advisor, in a position where he ended up having to resign. I think those two were experienced intelligence actors and knew a lot about how the Justice Department worked and the secret stuff. And if there were two people in the Trump administration who maybe could have found out what the FBI was up to and put a stop to it, it's probably the two of them. Once they were marginalized, I think the FBI had smooth sailing in continuing that investigation because, frankly, the Trump people did not get in the White House the kind of experienced people. Like, this wouldn't have continued with Bill Barr on hand.
Right.
You know, they needed people who could go toe-to-toe with Comey. You know, basically Comey intimidated them into thinking that if they inquired into what was going on, they'd be guilty of obstruction. And I think they needed somebody there who could you know, go toe-to-toe with Comey and said that's ridiculous. But they didn't have someone, unfortunately.
I never understood, Greg, I never understood why Sessions recused himself. Jeff Sessions, a good friend of mine. I wasn't in the administration. That was 2017. but I've known Jeff for many years, worked with him during the campaign, was very happy to see him as Attorney General. I believe he was the first senator to endorse Trump, but I never understood why he recused himself, because it seems like it's what Andy's saying. I mean, that opened the door to more and more FBI mischief.
Yeah, absolutely. And as I explain in detail in my book, The Russia Hoax, and in my second book, Witch Hunt, he didn't have to recuse himself.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't required. He was simply bowing to public pressure. Now, Barr would not have succumbed to that kind of pressure. And, you know, he would have shut this down. But once again, you know, James Comey's Machiavellian machinations is what led to Mueller and the special counsel. I mean, Comey, when he was finally and eventually fired for usurping the authority of the attorney general in the email case, he pilfered documents from FBI files, took them home, and leaked them to a friend of his for the sole purpose of having it published and triggering a special counsel, which just happened to be his longtime friend, colleague, mentor, Robert Mueller. Mueller never ran that investigation. I think we understood why when he eventually testified. It was run by Andrew Weissman. Weissman picked a team of partisan prosecutors.
Right.
Their only problem was there was no evidence of collusion. Despite their best efforts to find it, they never did. And, of course, in the end, the Mueller report said there was no evidence of a Trump-Russia collusion conspiracy. So, you know, all of this happened because of people like Comey. But it wouldn't have happened had Bill Barr been the attorney general at the outset. Sessions was way in over his head.
Yeah.
You know, he'd been a senator, and he didn't have the skills or ability or instincts to be an attorney general.
Fellas, let's take a quick break. If you would just hang on for a minute on the other side of the break. We're talking to Greg Jarrett, and we're talking to Andrew McCarthy. I'm Larry Kudlow. We'll be right back.
This is the Larry Kudlow Show. This is the Larry Kudlow Show.
We are talking about the Durham report and the Russian collusion fiasco. And I do want to just say once again, as I said at the very top of the show, Donald Trump was completely exonerated by this report. I don't want to lose sight of that. But there's a million things that have to be covered now. We don't have enough time to do it, but I want to ask, Andy, I'll start with you. We'll have to be a little brief on this.
Right.
Robert Wray, is he the guy to clean up this FBI, or is this going to have to wait until we get a strong Republican in the White House?
Yeah, Chris Wray, I think, Larry.
Chris Wray,
I think the FBI's got a lot of problems, and there are things that have to be fixed at a fundamental level, not just about the FBI, but FISA and a number of their other authorities.
Greg, I don't think it's going to get solved till we get a strong Republican back in the White House.
Yeah, I mean, the rot is so endemic at the DOJ, the FBI, so broken. It's embedded in the Bureau, and frankly, I think the hierarchy needs to be dismantled and rebuilt with honest people at the helm.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I'm with you on that 100%. Greg Jarrett, Fox News, Andy McCarthy, National Review. I'm Kudlow. Much more on the other side of the break.
This is the Larry Kudlow Show.
Welcome back, folks. I'm Larry Kudlow. We're going to bring in my pal Michael Faulkender, professor of finance at the University of Maryland, former assistant secretary of the Treasury for Economic Policy and the chief economist of the America First Policy Institute. Mike, thanks for doing this on a Saturday. I want to talk about the economy, but just, you know, you were in the Treasury for several years in a key spot. What's your take? What's the deadline? What's the X-day for the debt stuff now? Because, as you know, the talks, the so-called talks, are going nowhere. Surprise, surprise, the Democrats don't want to cut spending. Okay, that's a shocker, breaking news. But you have any thoughts on the actual, is Treasury going to run out of cash? Can they keep looting the retirement funds? What's going to happen here?
You know, that they not only can keep looting the retirement funds for a little while longer, but there are some steps that if they really were facing a cash crunch, I would have expected them to have already taken. So, you know, if you really were anticipating that you were going to run out of money in the Treasury's checking account, you would start not paying certain contractors or at least taking longer to pay some of the contractors. You'd start looking at furloughing non-essential government employees so that we could elongate the amount of time that we've got. And the fact that they're not doing those things, in fact, I was talking with some federal contractors earlier this week, and they're getting paid early. So, you know, that's kind of standard cash management that you would do in order to elongate that. So are they, as you've said before, are they wanting to hit this time frame so that they can create the hysteria and think that they can force, you know, a clean vote out of the House of Representatives? So I don't trust that they are really, you know, negotiating in good faith, because they, I think, ultimately want to shut things down and then think that they can keep spending.
Mm-hmm. Somehow force the Republicans into submission. It's not going to happen. I mean, I can just tell you, I'm in touch with all people on the GOP side.
It's not going to happen. And because the American people are with the Republicans on this.
Right.
I mean, poll after poll after poll that I've seen says, yes, we should rescind COVID money that hasn't been spent. Mm-hmm. We should cut back on the level of government spending back to where it was prior to the pandemic. Student loans should not be forgiven. Yes, there should be work requirements. And because remember, who are the work requirements for? Able-bodied, prime age, childless, right? In a 3.5% unemployment environment, why shouldn't the American people ask people in that situation to work as a condition to receive food stamps, TANF, and Medicaid?
Yeah, you're dead right on that. You know, one of the first things that happened when they started talking staff to staff was the Democrats immediately took the student loan cancellations off the table. And the other thing they did, Mike, was, you know, the Republicans in the McCarthy plan wanted to stop all these greeny tax credits that were in the misnamed Inflation Reduction Act, because they're for a lot of reasons, but among others, there are absolutely no limits. Those credits could go into the next 25 years. And as you may know, others, actually the CBO, but others like Goldman Sachs and so forth, have reestimated the cost of that bill to be over $1 trillion. They just took that right off the table. They didn't want to talk about it at all. And now they're bickering. They don't want a 1% cap. They don't want any caps for 10 years. I mean, you got $4.5-5 trillion of savings in there with the McCarthy caps. They just don't want to do it. They just took that stuff right off. And, you know, I think that's why Garrett Graves, you know, walked out yesterday morning. They had a 10-minute meeting, and it was more of the same, and he walked out. I know they came back last night, but nothing happened on that. I mean, they just don't want to cut spending. They don't want to go into the student loans. They don't want, you know, stop the green stuff. And the permitting. The permits that the Democrats want are only for renewables, no fossil fuels. How the hell can you? That's not a compromise.
No, not at all. I mean, and it is the fact that they are willing to blow up talks and put the country into default for the first time, exactly so that they can continue to forgive student loans that primarily goes to people in the, you know, upper 30% of the income distribution, that they won't cut back on all of these subsidies for EVs. Because like you've said, you know, Joe Manchin intentionally in the misnamed Inflation Reduction Act said, we need to have sourcing minimums in order to get these credits, because to the extent that the federal government is going to subsidize the transition to electric vehicles, then they ought to be made in the United States. Mm. And the Treasury Department just ignores them, just ignores the sourcing requirements. And that's why Goldman Sachs, among others, has come back and said, this is going to cost us a lot more, because CBO didn't think that we'd be able to meet many of these requirements on sourcing. Mm. And so they're just going to ignore them. And that's why that piece is gone. But the fact that there's an unwillingness to bring spending levels back to where they were prior to the pandemic. I mean, Larry, you and I both know, look at how strong 2019 was.
We had the biggest increase in household income. We had the lowest poverty rate, not just ever, but among all races, right? We had the lowest unemployment rate in 50 years. We had an economy hitting on all cylinders, but the Bidens' view of how to run the economy is you get big government and big labor and big business all together, and you divvy things up, and you remove any entrepreneurship, you remove any dynamism, and it's just government dependency. And they want to micromanage the, they want a central plan. And they refuse to give in on anything that's going to take them away from central planning, even if it means defaulting on the government's debt.
Yeah, I love that central planning. I talk about that all the time. This is like Soviet-style central planning. So
yeah, I remember sitting in those meetings where you were just advocating for central planning, Larry.
So, your points about furloughs and contracting is very important, so we need to watch for that. The CBO report came out, Michael, and they said if you get through the tax date, what is it, corporate tax date, June 15th, they probably have enough money to get through July, actually.
Yeah, so I remember I used to work with the office that puts together the monthly Treasury statement and do the press briefings. And there's very clear patterns. You know, April is always a surplus month because personal tax returns come in. And then, of course, June is usually a surplus month because you get the quarterly filings and the corporate tax payments. So once those receipts come in, you know, usually you run a surplus. So if you get past, I think, June 2nd, because Social Security checks go out that day, then you're back to being in a nice cash position for a little while. But, you know, because we're running a $1.5 trillion deficit this year, you are going to then start hitting some deficit months, and that's when you start worrying about the balance in the checking account again. So it's not like spending is a constant stream. There are these huge lumps, and if you get past a lump, then you're clear until the next one comes.
That's all very helpful. So one quickie, we got just a minute and a half. The index of leading indicators in April fell for the 13th straight month. What does that tell you?
Well, the economy continues to be in trouble. Households are running out of money. They're hitting credit card limits. Interest rates keep rising. And so, and then with the failure of the banks, we've seen that credit conditions are tightening. So if you think about the ways that households primarily fund their activities, it's first and foremost wages, but they're not keeping up with inflation. Second, it's savings. Households built that up during the pandemic, but savings rates are at terribly low levels. And then it's credit, and with tightening credit standards plus credit card debt hitting record highs, households are running out of funds to fund their consumption. That's, you know, 70% of gross output. And so the result is that they're going to be pulling back. And every indicator, as you said, has been telling us that more and more for the last 13 months. So the recession that I thought would already have been here still seems like it's coming.
Yeah, it's funny. The leading indicators, also things like the inverted yield curve, M2 money supply. I know that's not a perfect one, but you've got a lot of warning signs of recession. I'm not sure the stock market or Wall Street understands that, but I was kind of shocked by the leading indicator stuff. It was our friend Joe Lavornia that brought it to my attention. I don't follow that as much from the conference board, but that's a brutal number. It's down 8% year on year, Michael. And I we're not out of the woods. We may be going into the woods. That's, I think, what the bottom line is going to be here.
That's exactly right. And if you look at the Biden administration's budget submission, they're not at all calling for growth. I mean, this is an austerity government. I say austerity in terms of there's just going to be less to go around, right? I mean, the problem with central planning is that you remove the incentive for the private sector to generate more output. And, you know, there used to be a bipartisan consensus that we wanted growth. But, you know, if you look at the baseline budget, I know I'm going to get deep into the weeds here, but I know how much you love these conversations, Larry.
Just a few seconds.
And then the policy budget, right? The difference between those ought to generate growth, because the baseline is if we do nothing, the policy budget is if we do the administration's objectives. And yet there's no improvement in growth.
No,
because they no longer want growth.
It's redistribution. You know, they don't really care about growth. They've got ideological policy objectives. It's never growth. The left is never growth driven. In fact, it's, you know, maybe anti-growth driven. Anyway, Mike Faulkender of University of Maryland, former Assistant Secretary of the Treasury, America First Policy. Thank you, Mike. Appreciate it. Folks, quick break. And on the other side, we got my friend Greg Kelly from WABC and Newsmax. We want to talk about the illegal migrants coming into the interior of the country, especially in New York. Oh, my gosh, this is a big mess. I'm Kudlow. We'll take a quick break.
Larry Kudlow. Now back to the Larry Kudlow Show.
Welcome back, folks. I'm Larry Kudlow. Great pleasure bringing Greg Kelly, WABC radio host, his terrific show, 3 to 5 p.m. every day during the week. Also, Newsmax television anchor. Greg, thank you for this. We appreciate it. Hate to make you come out on a Saturday, but you're great.
Oh, Larry, I love it. Thank you so much. And I'm coming to you from what was formerly a great neighborhood, Midtown East, and things are falling apart really, really fast.
Well, so I want to ask you about this. Now, you've got this situation, open borders. You've got all these illegal migrants coming into the interior of the country. Now, in New York, let's talk about New York for a minute. My pal Liz Peek, who will be on the show later, writes a column about how they wanted to set up some kind of tent city in Central Park to house migrants. There are other horror stories about, you know, migrants in hotels, migrants replacing veterans, although that veteran story turned out not to be the case. But the reality is Mayor Eric Adams doesn't seem to know what he's supposed to do about this except complain and ask for more federal money. All right. Now, you know a lot about the local scene here. What is this all about? Where are we going here?
Well, I'm not shocked. We have an incompetent narcissist as mayor. He has no idea what to do. I warn people about this. I hate to say I told you so, but he fooled some people. He is a former police officer. He's going to be tough on law enforcement. He's going to be tough on these issues. No, he was a clown. He always has been a clown, not a serious man. He became mayor with about 200,000 votes in a city of 8 million people. 200,000 people made him the mayor. Mm. And you can see he has no operational skill, no governing skill, no political skill. Now he's in a fight with the Biden administration. Why is he in a fight with the Biden administration? Because it looks good to the New York Post. I love the New York Post, but he's all things to all people all the time, yeah. Right? No, yeah. Oh, isn't this great? Eric Adams is saying the right things on the border. In the meantime, he's not fixing the problem. You get on the phone. There are some things that have to be done behind the scenes. He's blowing it. He's in love with himself. And this Roosevelt Hotel, which is a very special place, quite frankly, to me in my heart. And I shouldn't say this, but I used to go to Star Trek conventions at the Roosevelt Hotel. I love that place. To me, it was the most glamorous place on earth. And do you remember, Larry, in Wall Street, the movie Wall Street with Michael Douglas?
Mm-hmm.
Greed is good. The Gordon Gekko greed is good moment.
Oh, was that meeting in Roosevelt?
Absolutely.
Oh, that's fabulous.
And during that little talk, he talks about how America is becoming a second-rate power.
Right.
And he talks about how we lost our industrial might. And that's 40 years ago almost,
yeah,
that movie.
Almost, yeah.
And in the middle of that, to see now it's going to be occupied by, illegals who have no business being here. It's heartbreaking. The whole damn thing is heartbreaking.
Roosevelt was a big Republican hangout.
Tom Dewey actually had his he didn't have his victory party there. He had his defeat party. The Republican state party was based there. And now for this to happen, it's very much representative of a city in decline. You know, it was a great hotel. Then it started to decline. Then Pakistan bought the hotel, actually. And then it totally shuttered during COVID. And now this. And quite frankly, look, I'm sorry, I don't trust these people. We don't know who they are. They have not sworn allegiance to the United States. If you go back to the 2020 convention with Trump, my favorite moment during that convention, five people from all over the world, from Africa, from South Asia, all over the place, come in and take the citizenship oath. They did all the right things, amazing people from all over the world. And you take that citizenship oath, you promise to take up arms for the country, that you support our ideals and the Constitution. These people don't have to do that. We don't know who the hell they are or what their agenda is. I don't know if you've been watching Gordon Chang, but all these military-age men from China coming in, we're in big, big trouble. And
the Russians coming in. The Russians coming across the border. One of them was interviewed on Fox. Blew my mind. Really? Russians? Really? Okay. So, Greg, what's going to happen? You know, I had Congresswoman Claudia Tenney on the TV show last night, and she was reminding on this point that that these migrants are filtering through upstate New York. I don't just mean Rockland County and Orange County, all the way up. You know, she's way up in the Syracuse area, and they don't know where to put them, and they don't really want them. So what are we going to do? I mean, it's an Eric Adams problem, but it's a Hochul problem. What's going to happen here?
Well, number one, if Eric Adams were to suddenly become a wise, mature man overnight, which is not going to happen, you have to have you have to talk to Governor Abbott immediately. You have to make peace with the Biden administration immediately. I can't stand the Biden administration, but you don't talk about high schools and gymnasiums, all right? Now, we do have Rikers Island. Yeah. There are arrangements that can be made. There are prisons all over the place that are no longer prisons. They're defunct structures that could be used for this purpose. And that's a Band-Aid. I mean, we have to stop the hemorrhaging at the border, of course. You know, the initial idea he came up with, you know, a broken clock is right every now and then, Randall's Island. But, of course, he didn't think about how people would get there. He made no other arrangements. The buses were still going to Port Authority, so nobody was going to Randall's Island. He totally screwed that up. But those are just Band-Aids. Quite frankly, I talked about it for a little while. It's too far away. It's too far away. We need a new mayor, and the election isn't until 2025. So there's no easy answer here. Some creative thinking about intercepting these buses. If you have an emergency health order, there are all kinds of things you can do that we did post 9/11. But they're not creative people. They just love going on TV and seeing their name and picture in the paper.
The migrants are a health risk. That's another issue. I mean, left off, you know, the Bidens did not replace Title 42, and COVID may have passed, but there's still major public health issues, and so they're spreading out across the country, and they're not, you know, really tested, and they could have diseases. They may not even know they have diseases, but the Bidens have let that go because of their open border policy. Greg Kelly, let me just ask you, what's your assessment now of the law and order situation in New York City, the policing situation? Is it any better?
No, it's getting worse. You see the climate everywhere you go. Police have been totally held back. I understand that as well. If they act aggressively, they open themselves up to being jailed or prosecuted. Quality of life is getting worse. Aggressive panhandling, shoplifting. It's a completely different city. And quite frankly, with the migrant situation, I mean, we could have full-on riots. We really could have full-on riots within the next couple of months. And the cops, this is a very dangerous, uneasy time. It may take a miracle. It really may take a miracle. You know, I'm not sure where you are on you work for Donald Trump, and I really would love to see him back. I think that he is the kind of the antidote to a lot of what's happening right now. It may take a miracle, but a miracle miracles have a way of finding Donald Trump. Let me put it that way.
Well, remember, as we were talking earlier in this show about the Durham report, Donald Trump was completely exonerated in that report. So that's going to give him a leg up. Anyway, Greg Kelly, thank you, my friend. I appreciate it very, very much. Folks, I'm Kudlow. We're going to take a break. On the other side of the break, we're going to do some stock market work with Stephanie Link and Kenny Polcari. Please stick around. Much more to come.
It's the Larry Kudlow Show. Free market prosperity starts here. Now, here's Larry Kudlow.
Welcome back, folks. I'm Larry Kudlow. This is the Larry Kudlow Show. Great pleasure to be with you. Just for a reset, by the way, you can get this show on the internet, live streaming, LarryKudlow.com. No, LarryKudlowShow.com. LarryKudlowShow.com. Throughout the country, around the world, throughout the solar system and the Milky Way, wherever that happens to be. And during the week on television, you can watch us, the Fox Business Network, Monday through Friday, every day, 4 to 5 p.m. The name of the show is Kudlow. And if you can't get to us at 4, just text your favorite 9-year-old, and she will show you how to DVR the show. It's not hard. Anyway, let's do some stock market work. We've got Stephanie Link, Chief Investment Strategist at Hightower Advisors and Head of Investment Solutions, and Kenny Polcari, Managing Director at Case Capital Advisors and Chief Market Strategist at Slatestone Wealth. Welcome to both of you. Stephanie Link, stock market interest rates went up this week. I'm just looking at the sheets. 2-year note went up 28 basis points. The 10-year note went up 21 basis points, 367. The 30-year mortgage rate up 10 basis points, 699. Call that 7%. Ha, ha, ha. We had terrible numbers on existing home sales. The index of leading indicators, Ms. Link, fell in April for the 13th consecutive month. The index of leading indicators put out by the conference board. So what do you make of it? Before we get to the Fed and all that, what do you make of it? What is the economy doing? What is the stock market doing?
Well, and thanks for having me. And it's
always
great to be on with Kenny. And it's great to be with Kenny, too. I think near term, The speculation that we might get a debt ceiling resolution, that's been the near-term catalyst, and it's helped the markets. That being said, underneath the surface, it's been only big tech. That's the story of the year. That has saved the day for now. The top five tech names are counting for about 90% of the return so far. So it's very, very narrow. But, you know, the market's not collapsing like a lot of the bears have been expecting. And I think the reason, Larry, is because yes, you cited a couple of the negative data points in the economy. The economy overall is holding up. You mentioned housing, existing home sales. No one wants to sell a home, right? If their mortgage is a 4%, and if they sell it, then they have to go out and get a 6% mortgage. But I think new home sales is more interesting to me. And while it's still depressed, it's at a 1-year high. And the NAHB index, National Association of Home Builders, sentiment. It's the highest since September 22nd. So I'm not saying housing is great, but I think housing is troughing, number one. Number two, manufacturing. I know the ISMs are still crummy and in contraction mode, but if I listen to what some of these companies are telling me and us in conference calls, there's like a renaissance happening in the manufacturing industry because of the government stimulus, because of reshoring, because of energy transition, because of electrification. And you know that it's only 12, manufacturing is only 12% of the economy, but there is a multiplier effect. And for every one job created in manufacturing, 7 jobs are created around it. So that brings me to jobs. Initial claims have actually remained pretty strong, right? I mean, a 4-week moving average is down 16,000. I know it's still up 7% year over year, but very contained. And so you add it all up, and the Atlanta Fed number, GDP now, is for the second quarter is tracking at 2.9%. That's better than what I think a lot of people, including myself, were expecting.
What do you do with the index of leading indicators? What does that do?
I pay attention to it, but I also pay attention to the concern in the bank lending standards.
Yep.
It hasn't had an impact yet, and we'll get to the Fed and all that, but not perfect, Larry, not perfect by any means, but I'm looking at a couple of things, and I'm saying there are offsets, right? There are puts and takes. I just don't think it's as bad and as gloomy as people are expecting, and I think that's what's helped the market in check, because earnings have held in check.
Ken Felgari, Stephanie has just given us the glass is half full. What are you saying?
Well, so listen, I think it's very, and it's a pleasure to be on with you and Steph. It is interesting because, to her point, there's only a half a dozen names that are holding this market up. If those names start to struggle, then you'll see kind of the market pull back, I think, and you'll see the real weakness. But that being said, I do agree that there is some positive news out there. There are things to kind of pay attention to in terms of manufacturing and the economy holding up and earnings holding up. They weren't nearly as bad as they were originally expected to be in the second quarter. I think we came in at, what, down 4% versus, I think the expectation was down 6.5% originally as we moved into the earnings season. So I do see some bright lights, but I got to tell you, I'm not so sure the debt ceiling thing is playing that much of a role, because whoever really thought that the U.S. was going to default in the first place? We were never going to default, no matter what happens. They're going to make it all dramatic, and they're going to take it to the 11th hour, and they're going to, you know, go back and forth and say, look at how hard we worked to get this. We were never going to default. So I think while maybe it's playing this short-term plus, because they've changed the language, they're not using inflammatory language, now we're getting a debt deal done, I think that's taking some of the edge off. But the truth is, once we get through the debt ceiling, it's going to focus once again on inflation, what's going to happen with PCE at the end of the month, what's going to happen with CPI, PPI, what's the Fed going to do? There's now talk of not only a June rate hike, but you've got some in the Fed talking about even a 6% terminal rate, which I don't think the market's prepared for. And I think that's going to cause a cap on the market now and cause it to pull back a little bit. Not a disaster. I don't think we're going Morgan Stanley S&P 3000, not by any stretch. But I wouldn't be surprised if we test it again closer to 4,000 after we get through the debt ceiling.
By the way, whatever it's worth, and I'm not sure it matters to the stock market, yesterday the talks collapsed. They had a 10-minute right. meeting in the morning, and then they walked out. And then everybody was so freaked out, they came back at 6:30, but then they walked out of that meeting, too. And no new meetings are scheduled. Now, maybe that'll change. Maybe they'll have a meeting tomorrow. I mean, it's an impasse. I'm not worried about debt default. In fact, I'm in favor of shutting down the government, always have been. I would shut it down for long periods of time. It would be very helpful to the economy. Let me ask you this. Earnings reports and other commentary from consumer companies like Walmart and Target and Home Depot, what are those big firms telling us about consumers?
Who are you asking?
You can continue. I want to get both of you in this, but go ahead. You were on a roll there for a minute.
Listen, I just want to clarify one thing. When you said shut the government down, that's separate from defaulting. Am I correct? Because I don't have a problem with shutting the government down, but yeah, the U.S. is not going to default.
No, no, we'll never default. Right? We have revenues right. to pay the interest on the 10-year. Right. It's not going to be a problem. Right. I'm just saying,
right.
My generic view as a free market capitalist, looking at what's going on in Washington, you want to shut the government down for 6 months, I'm all for it. Right. Now, that's a sidebar.
Agreed.
That's a sidebar. Yeah, yeah. I argued the same way when I was in the Trump administration. Shut it down, I don't care.
Right. So let's get back to the
Except
consumer.
I was an essential worker.
I think there's two stories going on here, right? The one was the Home Depot disappointment that we got earlier in the week. And then we saw Target and Walmart, you know, come out with a different story. They were better. Their guidance was better. But I think there's two different things going on there. Home Depot is all about, you know, renovating your house, do it yourself, fixing things up. And I think people are tired of that after they did that during COVID. They spent time kind of making the place pretty and all that. I think now they want different experiences. But on the other side, then you've got this looming recession coming. You have people that are nervous about what the future is. And so names like Walmart and Target, which appeal to, discounted products and better prices and all that stuff, are going to force the consumer to start to look there for more of their needs, even more so than they did. So I think the two different stories, I think the Home Depot story is a very specific story about people just tired about, at the moment, fixing up the house, spending the money.
They probably fixed them all up during COVID.
They probably fixed it up, correct.
Stephanie, though, what did you learn from Walmart and Target?
So I learned that the four names that reported this week, being TJX, Target, Walmart, and Home Depot, we learned a little bit about everything. I think the guidance is definitely conservative, but the overall earnings actually held up remarkably well, considering everyone thinks that the consumer is going in the toilet. We had a beat and raise from TJX, and admittedly, they will benefit from people trading down and all the excess inventory in the system because they buy all that stuff, right? And then they sell it at a discount, and that's the story. So not a surprise on TJ, very well positioned for the long term. I want to highlight throughout all of the names, every single company said freight costs are down, and that helped margins. And I think that's going to be a theme throughout retail. That's a good thing. So even if the consumer slows down a bit, and I think they will, but I think they're going to still spend. But even if they do, they're offsetting it with lower costs across the board. Inflation has come down for these companies, so they're able to see higher margins. The second theme that I think is going to be throughout this earnings season for retail is inventories. Inventories at Target were down 16%, right? And their discretionary piece of inventories was down 25%. So that, too, is going to help the margin side of the equation. And I thought Target, there are a couple of things they did, company-specific, that were better than expected. Like I said, inventories, operating margins, gross margins. So while the consumer is slowing down a little bit and guidance was a little slow for the next couple of quarters, I'm not really that worried. Walmart is a shining star because they have all grocery, right? 60% of their revenues is grocery, and that's where the consumer is spending, that and services. Home Depot, I think it's rear-view looking, and I think we went from 2023 of being the earnings fear of numbers coming down to we're kind of troughing. If I'm right, and I think we see a housing pickup in the second half of the year and into next year, Home Depot is going to be the place where you want to go, and it's trading at a very attractive multiple. So I think there are company specifics across the board, but I think they're handling the situation the best that they can, and there are puts and takes. But I do not think any of these companies said the consumer is absolutely dead. Not at all. They're slowing, not dead.
I worry about the consumer because the EPA has forbidden you now. You can't buy a gas stove. You can't buy a shower head. You can't buy a toilet. You can't buy an air conditioner. You can't buy a new car. I mean, it's very difficult. All these climate change policies, you can't buy anything. You can't buy a light bulb. I mean, it's nothing. What can I buy, Stephanie? I can't buy anything. They're not going to let me buy anything because it doesn't meet the EPA's climate standards. It's very difficult living in America today. Very difficult.
I think there are plenty of things you can buy, but we are out. Kenny hit on it earlier. The consumer still is out and about on services, right? We know that that's the strength. That's going to slow too, but it's certainly been resilient and strong. And if you listen to the airlines and you listen to the cruise lines and you listen to all of the services companies, the casinos, I mean, they're just doing spectacularly well, and they're not seeing any kind of slowdown. It's just we went from a goods buying consumer to a services one, and the goods are going to come back eventually. We just have we have some puts and takes within the consumer.
I worry about the airline business.
I mean, I do too. I don't want to own an airline, but I just want to listen to what they have to say about bookings. But I would just say the one last thing, the consumer remains strong because the job market remains strong. So
Flying has to be very difficult because it's going to be all powered by windmills. It's going to be very difficult.
It's going to be very difficult now. You've all traveled. I got to tell you, you go to any airport, they're overcrowded. Every seat on the plane is taken. And by the way, Steve, prices have done nothing but go up. Try buying a plane ticket now. The prices are absolutely incredible, and every plane is full. It's crazy. I just went on that cruise. There were plenty of people on the cruise. The ship was full of people, and everyone was enjoying themselves and having a great time. And so to the experience side of the consumer, I think that's what they're looking for. They're tired of being locked down. They're tired of just doing that stuff. They want to get out and about.
Kenny, pictures were gorgeous on Twitter.
Where'd you go?
I was on that Steve Forbes Investment Summit cruise
that started in Venice and went down
the Adriatic all the way to Istanbul, Turkey, and back to Athens. It was really spectacular. But the cruise ship, you know, was a region. It was Norwegian Cruise Line, but it was their boutique cruise line. So it's only a smaller ship, 600 people on the ship plus 400 workers. It was really, really spectacular.
Why, kids, why is oil only $70? With the Saudis cut oil production, allegedly, by over a million. But oil's really done nothing. So I'm looking crude oil, WTI, 71.5. Brent crude, 75.5. Are you surprised at the weakness in oil?
Yes.
I am surprised.
Me too. Kenny, go ahead.
No, I'm surprised. I figured that, and I think what you're going to hear on June 4th when OPEC meets again is that they're going to rattle the cages about cutting production even more, because the Saudis don't like $70 oil. They like $80 is their sweet spot. Certainly 90 is even better. But I think that's what you're going to hear in June. But yes, to your point, I'm a little bit confused on why oil is trading down here at 70. They keep, you know, one day they come up with the China's not growing as fast story, and then the U.S. demand is declining and the recession's coming and demand destruction. I think all that's baloney, because I think there's plenty of energy demand around the world, not only here but around the world. So I am confused on why oil's trading at $70. I certainly expected it to be higher, close to 80 anyway.
By the way, I got to take a break, but I forgot, you can't buy a washing machine either. Anyways, Stephanie Link, Hightower Advisors and Investment Solutions, Kenny Polcari, Case Capital, and Slatestone Wealth. I'm Kudlow. We'll be right back.
This is the Larry Kudlow Show. This is the Larry Kudlow Show.
We're talking stocks with Stephanie Link, Chief Investment Strategist at Hightower Advisors, Head of Investment Solutions, and Kenny Polcari, Managing Partner at Case Capital Advisors and Chief Market Strategist at Slatestone Wealth. Kenny Polcari, Jay Powell wants to pause interest rates, or so it seems. The meeting is in June. What do you think?
So I think they do. I think they raise in June and then pause. I think that's the announcement, because they want to get the terminal rate to the 5.25-5.5% range, which in my mind meets and just kisses where inflation is. Now, you can use two different numbers, right? The CPI top number is 4.9%, but ex food and energy was 5.5%. So whichever argument you want to use, they want to get the terminal rate at least above or at the inflationary rate. So which is why I think in June you're going to see a rate increase of 25 basis points. And then they're going to say at this moment, we're going to pause after that. We're going to give it a couple of months. We're going to watch it. We're going to see. But they're not taking out further rate hikes off the table. And the pivot idea, that's out for 2023. Anyone who still thinks the Fed's going to pivot 23, you better be careful what you wish for, because the only reason they're going to pivot is if something falls completely off the edge, or we get some black swan event that we weren't expecting that sends the economy into a complete tailspin.
You mean pivot meaning rates will fall?
Pivot meaning cut. Cut. Right. Yeah. They're pricing in 75 basis point cuts by Christmas, which makes zero sense to me. I'd be curious to see what, Stephanie, what do you think?
Yeah, Steph, what's your Fed watch?
Yeah, I think that's, I think there's a very good chance they go in June. I'm looking at the Philly Fed regional manufacturing series last week, and the number is still negative, but it was a lot better than feared, if you will. But the prices paid index went higher, and we know where CPI is, we know where core PCE is, we know where unit labor cost is, all elevated well above what the Fed wants. So I think they go. But I would say that you're in the eighth or ninth inning in terms of the Fed doing what they're going to do. If they do another one after June, maybe that's it. But to Kenny's point, no, I think they stay higher for longer. This inflation story is not going away. It's very sticky. It has to do with jobs and wages and services, which take a long time. We know that there's a lag impact of what the Fed does, right, by about a year and a half or so. And we're basically just at the year point, right, a little over a year in terms of what they've been doing. So we're going to slow. The inflation will eventually come down, but I don't think it's going to be this year. So, no, they may pause, but no pivot.
Right. Does it matter that M2 money supply is crashing and that Ed Hyman is now predicting negative in Q3, negative GDP in Q4, negative GDP in Q1? Kenny?
I don't know how you go from something like 2.5% GDP in the second quarter to all of a sudden negative. I think we're going to slow down. But I think that I still think there's a lot of stimulus in the system from all the stuff that we did over the last 3 years. It takes a long time to get that out of the system, right?
Yeah.
So to me, I'm not sure if it's a recession or a soft landing. I don't think it's a hard one, though. I just don't. And again, I point back to the consumer.
Soft landing link. That's what we're going to do. Soft landing link. Stephanie Link and Ken Polcari. Both of you kids, thank you ever so much. Folks, we're going to take a quick break. And the other side, we're going to do some money in politics with Liz Peek and Steve Moore. I'm Kudlow. Please stay with us.
This is the Larry Kudlow Show.
Welcome back, folks. I'm Larry Kudlow. We are here doing money in politics with Liz Peek, Fox News contributor and syndicated columnist, and Steve Moore, vice president of Freedom Works and Committee to Unleash Prosperity Hotline, and host of the popular show More Money, right here on WABC, following this show on most of these very same stations, More Money. So, kids, welcome back. Steve Moore, I go to you. The debt talks have broken down. They met for 10 minutes yesterday morning and then walked away. And then they came back at 6:30 for a few minutes and walked away. And there's no new meetings scheduled. And I think, talking to people, I got a couple of moles in these talks. Breaking news. Hold on. Wait a second. The Democrats don't want to cut spending. It's a shocking headline, and I want to get your opinion about this because you are a budget expert. What do you think?
Look, I think that the Republicans are holding all the cards here. We talked a little bit about this last week, and nothing's really changed in that regard. The Democrats are behind an eight ball. Americans do want a debt ceiling bill that actually cuts debt. What a concept. And so my worry as a conservative and someone who does believe that we have out-of-control spending is I don't want to see the Republicans giving away too much at the negotiating table. They have a very good bill, very sensible, very common sense. Everybody's for drilling. Everybody's for work for welfare. Everybody's for, putting some caps on this enormous increase in spending. So Don't back away here. I just want to mention two other things that I think are really important, and I don't want to see Republicans giving away at the bargaining table. I'm staunchly against hiring 87,000 new IRS agents. I think it's outrageous, and I think those agents will be weaponized against conservatives and Republicans as they were under the Obama administration. And also, I feel pretty strongly about this $300 billion green energy slush fund, which is completely, unnecessary. It's not going to change the temperature of the planet, but it's going to funnel massive amounts of money into the coffers of left-wing interest groups. So I want Kevin McCarthy to play his strong hand and not negotiate away the things that are really important here.
Well, Scott Perry, of the head of the Freedom Caucus, Liz, was on the show, Thursday night. He said that the Republicans have a good plan, as Steve just mentioned, and they should hold tough. I spoke to Kevin McCarthy Friday afternoon. He intends to hold tough. Trouble is the Democrats really don't want work requirements, okay? That's surfacing in this. They don't want permitting other than for renewables. They do not want permitting for any fossil fuels. Furthermore, they ruled the student loan cancellations off the table, the idea of repealing that off the table. And basically, they don't want tight caps, and they don't want any caps for more than a year or two. They don't want it for 10 years. They want a two-year debt ceiling. In other words, as it turned out in the last couple of days in these meetings with the White House and the McCarthyites, the House Republicans, there's no agreement really on any key point. The only agreement I can find is a COVID clawback, which might come to $50 billion some odd dollars. But that's it. That's it. So we're here. What they hoped would be a deal this weekend, we're here on Saturday. Now it's Saturday afternoon with nothing. What do you think, Liz?
Yeah, I think it's kind of interesting because there were certainly more hopeful comments being made going into the weekend. Kevin McCarthy sounded more positive. At least that's how it was reported. It's a little interesting to know how that shifted. I don't know whether the Democrats finally woke up to polling that they, you know, that didn't sound like they should give in. But let's remember the only plan on the table
is a Republican plan from the House. The Senate hasn't passed anything. So Democrats have yet to come up with their program. And I think, honestly, you can talk about all the issues that Steve and you have raised that obviously are commonsensical. Most Americans agree on it. But let's just look at this in the starkest of terms. We had a bubble of spending caused by the pandemic. That bubble has to go away. We have to go back to the main trend line that we were on before COVID threw trillions of dollars, $5 trillion of dollars into the hopper. And I actually think that's a very simple thing for most Americans to understand. And it's why I think the public has been behind the GOP bill. So I think they just need to keep hammering that, just keep saying, look, we spent a huge amount of money because we had this horrible thing happen. We can't just go on and pretend that's the new trend line because it's not. But
well, Democrats,
I think the student loan thing, I really am kind of surprised. I guess I'm surprised that that has kind of resurfaced as a major sticking point because that's really not popular with most Americans.
Well, it's a sticking point. By the way, your point about pre-pandemic is a good point. It's a very fiscally sound point, but they won't do it. Democrats won't do it.
Yeah.
Moreover, they will not. One of the battles going on here is reverting back to the FY 2022 baseline. They won't do that either. And the Democrats do not want a 1% spending cap. They want a higher spending cap, but whatever that is, and there's no number yet, they will only apply it for the first year or two. They will not apply it to 10 years. So you had in the McCarthy package, which is the only game in town, you're both quite right, the $4.5 to $5 trillion worth of savings over 10 years. Democrats don't want it. They just don't want it, which is why I say breaking news. Democrats don't want to cut spending. They just don't. I mean, I don't know. It may change, but right now there's nothing.
Well, so right now I'm a little bit more radical than even I guess you are, Larry, because, you know, one of my heroes in the Congress is Rand Paul. And I think you said this on your show, you know, back to the 2022 baseline. Let's go back to the 2019 baseline.
Yeah, that's right.
If you do that, you basically balance the budget. And so, you know, my point is that the Republican plan is hardly radical. You know, it's in fact, I would cut a lot more spending than they will. The other thing I just wanted to mention, I'm just shocked at how strongly the Democrats are against work requirements. And I was reading a bunch of stories this morning about this, and they kept saying, well, gosh, if we have these work requirements, we're going to remove all these people from public programs. I'm like, that's the point. And they said, you know, all these people are going to have to, you know, replace their, you know, welfare benefits with earnings. You know what? That's what 95% of American families do.
Children are going to starve. Children are going to starve.
Really unbelievable.
The only problem is the work requirement is for people without kids. But put that aside. Children are going to starve.
I wanted to mention that. You know, my problem with those work requirements is they're kind of mamby-pamby, actually. because what we did back in 96 is we actually put welfare mothers into the workforce, and they actually started working, and they started climbing. So I don't know why they would be exempt from this. And the other thing is, you know, in some of the I don't know the specifics of all the provisions, but even in some of the Republican plans, it's only 20 hours a week. I don't know, Larry, about you and Liz, but I'm working a lot more than 20 hours a week right now.
20?
Yeah. But you know,
we're all working on the weekends here. We're all sick. Look at this. It's Saturday morning, and we're working. Huh? That's a work. I want the Senate to have work requirements. All of them. They have to come back and work, for Christ's sake. They don't work. They're always away. I want Joe Biden to have a work requirement.
My impression about the work requirements is it's not just the federal law they want to go after. It's state regulations. A lot of states during COVID basically threw out the 20 hours. I mean, I don't think it's just that this bill is going after. They want to make sure that all the states, particularly Democrat-led states, rescind the sort of supposedly temporary changes they made in response to COVID. But But to your point, all of you, look, I think the GOP has to win this in the court of public opinion. And I think the way you do that is you just make it clear that we are have to kind of roll back the tide of spending that was specifically for COVID. I mean, Democrats, if you remember, passed the $1.9 trillion American Rescue Plan after COVID, after the economy was already rebounding strongly, saying it was still a COVID bill. It wasn't a COVID bill. And I think most people recognize that. So let's get rid of all this garbage that came out of that and the Inflation Reduction Act, and let's go back to sensible governing. I mean, I really do think they can win this. And Larry, I liked your piece that came out talking about Republicans negotiating against themselves, because that's really where they are right now.
Well, I think they, I think Scott Perry gave some backbone to the leadership, and they need to just stick with their plan. And the plan, what would the plan do? It would curb spending, as you say, it would stop the frenzy, it would sort of unmask the Biden spending, but at the end of the day, it would reduce inflation and increase growth. You have some supply-side incentives in there, and you have some anti-inflationary incentives in there. It would also make the Federal Reserve's job much easier. Those are macroeconomic points. They probably need to keep making that because, after all, inflation is still sticky, real wages are still soft, et cetera, et cetera. And the economy is, I don't know if the economy is going to grow or not. The index of leading indicators is now down 13 straight months. That can't be a good signal. For all, you know, all those kinds of reasons. But, Steve, you know, they're going to have the X date is going to be moved. I mean, the June 1st thing is going to have to be moved.
Sure. Of course.
Right. I mean, for two reasons. One's political, to leave more room for negotiations. The other one's fiscal. They're not going to run out of money. They're not going to run out of money. Right. I mean, that's a silly, silly idea. I had Mike Falkender on before, so he was the one of the assistant Treasury secretaries. If they were worried about this stuff, they would slow down or stop the payments to contractors, and they'd start furloughing workers off. And they're not doing either of those things. So, I think this is all a lot to do about nothing. Basically, the Democrats don't want to cut spending. They don't want to do what Liz just suggested. And by the way, Steve, you are more radical than I am. That's a generic.
Like, they don't want to cut spending. They don't want to get people off welfare. They do want to give people free student loans and you know, forgive, you know, people. And that means the rest of us pay more taxes for that. One other quick thing, you know, we're not exactly right when we say the Democrats don't have a plan. They actually do have a plan, and it came out in January or February of this year. It was the president's budget. Yeah. And I think Republicans should be talking about this. Is lunacy. I mean, I did a piece for the Wall Street Journal. If you take all those taxes, tax on unrealized capital gains, double the capital gains tax, increase the dividend tax, increase the millionaire tax, you're talking about, Larry, an effective real capital gains tax rate of 80%. Who is going to invest in America with these? That's the alternative, folks. Look at what Joe Biden has proposed. This is the most radical budget ever put on the table, and I wish Republicans would talk more about that, because that's the only thing Democrats have put on the table.
By the way, in the first meetings of these meetings, the Democrats wanted a wealth tax. That was part. They put it on the table.
As there's a very good chance we go into a recession. I mean, you know, there really is sort of an insistent drumbeat from economists looking at what Jay Powell is doing. A lot of them are incredulous that he keeps raising rates. And now, in fact, Jay Powell in the last 48 hours has begun to sound a little more tempered on this. But this is not the time to have this whopping huge tax increase that just comes with the elimination of the Trump tax cuts.
All right. We got to take a quick break. Liz Peek, Fox News, Steve Moore, Committee to Unleash Prosperity, and more money right after the show. He's got a show. I'm Kudlow. We'll be right back.
Larry Kudlow. This is the Larry Kudlow Show.
This is, you know, the problem is he has literally no idea where to put people. I mean, they're trying to put him upstate. Upstate doesn't want him. Nobody wants him. The thing to do is to rescind the sanctuary city designation, but they'll never do that.
Steve Moore, what are we going to do with all these illegal migrants? Seriously. I mean, open borders, it's nonstop. There's no replacement for Title 42. There's no Remain in Mexico. There's no wall. I mean, in a sense, I look at this. I mean, this is a political issue. This is a sovereignty issue. This is a law and order issue. This is a drug issue. This is a cartel issue. But among other things, when these migrants come into the interior of the country, what are we going to do with them? I mean, there's not going to be free welfare and free medical care and education and all the rest of it. I mean, it's a humanitarian problem. In a sense, I feel sorry for them. Hello? Steve Moore, are you there?
I think you have to wonder, Larry, why it is this is happening in the first place. And we had a little cartoon in our hotline the other day about, you know, all the migrants, you know, flowing across the border, and there was the Democratic donkey handing out, you know, voter forms to all these people. So I'm usually not very that cynical, but I think a lot of people do believe that this is about winning elections and importing millions of new illegals. I saw a statistic, by the way, the other day. I can't verify its accuracy, but if we stay on this current path we're on, which is letting all these migrants come in, by the end of Biden's first term, more illegals will come in than all of the legal immigrants who came in through Ellis Island. That's how bad it is.
Boy. I mean, you know, we need immigrants, legal immigrants. We need we need new legislation. We need reforms. I mean, they want to come to America because America, you know, has prosperity and is a democracy and so forth and so on. I get that, but we should do it legally. And now that we're in a position where millions of them are here, and it's like Liz, you know, the Central Park thing is being repeated in various degrees in other major cities across the country. People don't know what to do with them. They don't know where to put them. I mean, even here in New York State, you know, way, way upstate, I had Claudia Tenney on the show a couple nights ago. She's upstate congresswoman, Syracuse, Rochester area. You know, they don't know what to do with them up there. I mean, it's humanitarian, among other things.
Well, without a doubt. And you know, hundreds of people have actually died trying to get to the United States because there has been this open border. This is a travesty, Larry. But one thing that is interesting to me, Hispanics are furious about this. I don't know if you saw Politico or somebody had a piece up recently about Biden's rank and approval ratings amongst Hispanics is plunging. Well, my Hispanic cleaning lady came into me the other day and said, what are they doing? Why don't they stop this? Because these people, the migrants, are not going to your neighborhood. They're not going to my neighborhood. They are going to all the Latino neighborhoods and causing havoc in the schools, havoc in the hospitals. I mean, there's a number of things we can talk about on this. I really do think the majority of Americans have a very common sense approach to immigration. Like Canada, we should allow people in who have certain attributes, who can actually improve our country. Canada does that. We don't do that at all. That was part of the Trump proposal, as I recall.
Yes.
And it's something that's very popular. I mean, there are middle of the road kind of common sense things we can do. What we have to do, though, is stop illegal immigration. Nobody wants it except Democrats who are looking to future voters. But it's an appalling breakdown of the rule of law, which, by the way, I think we see in all kinds of places. But this is not acceptable.
You know, Steve, I'd like to see some GOP people put up a good immigration reform plan. Now, I don't know the House plan. Have you looked at the House plan? I mean, it restores some of the Remain in Mexico and the wall. I know that. But I don't know. Did it have any of the things Liz is talking about, you know, where you've got to speak English, you've got to show that you can earn a livelihood, you've got to know something about American civics and American history? I mean, that's the kind of, there's got to be a positive attribute, a positive part of this story.
Well, look, I'm very pro-immigrant, as you know, Larry, and I think immigrants really are amazingly beneficial to the United States, but they have to come in lawfully. We have to know who's coming in. And, you know, I work with you and Brooke Rollins and others in the White House, we had a good immigration plan, Larry.
Yeah.
We had a really great immigration plan. Control the border and then let the people want to come in here and work and, you know, contribute to our society. Why can't we do that?
We should. Liz Peek, thank you. Steve Moore, thank you, kids. Steve Moore Show, followers this one. I'm Kudlow. We'll be back next weekend.